2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Rhett Beard, and today in the studio, it's the anniversary of REM issuing their Declaration of Independence as a musical document.
This one goes out to the one I love. Fire!
Well, you know, the great thing about rock and roll, I mean, it's not classical music. On any given night, almost any band can be the best band on earth, which I that's what I like about it. That's why it's so hard to be a rock critic. You know, there isn't any way to say what's better. It's what you like. And I've seen local bands that on any given night will just absolutely blow my mind, and you walk out going, wow, that's it.
Where we never made giant steps to make ourselves a viable hit-making American band for American radio. Radio came to us, and to my count, probably 3 times in 23 years. Pop culture just swung into our little stubborn trajectory, and we were in the same orbit a couple of times.
Hi, this is Peter Buck of REM, In the Studio.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe for the Best of REM, In the Studio, Part 1.
REM's beginnings are almost storybook. Guitarist Peter Buck met singer Michael Stipe in a record store in the university town of Athens, Georgia, amidst the social atmosphere of academic enlightenment, artistic freedom, and first-time adult relationships that can define American college experiences. REM was not assembled with any calculation. Instead, the additions of drummer Bill Berry and bass player singer Mike Mills completed REM's lineup as naturally as morning dew on a Georgia peach. True friendship and mutual respect has been the glue that bonded and sustained REM for almost 3 decades, and their refreshing approach both to music and their career elevated each to new heights in artistic integrity. A prolific band of road warriors throughout the 1980s, REM had already released 5 full-length albums by the time 1987's document landed them on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine with the bold 3-word rhetorical question, America's best band? I asked REM guitarist Peter Buck about that coveted honor.
Well, the one I always remembered was Alice Cooper with the snake. You know, that was when Rolling Stone still folded over. And I remember getting it because I subscribed when I was like 13, and I got it in my mailbox, and I was like, wow, I had to hide it from my mom. You know, I wasn't sure she'd appreciate it. So, when I go, well, I'm right up there with Alice, I'm happy with that. Well, you know, the great thing about rock and roll, I mean, it's not classical music. On any given night, almost any band can be the best band on earth, which I that's what I like about it. It's not... That's why it's so hard to be a rock critic. You know, there isn't any way to say what's better. It's what you like, and I appreciate that. You know, I mean, I certainly wouldn't make any claim that we're the best band in the world, or even in America, or even in whatever city we happen to be in. But you know, any band can be, and I've seen local bands that on any given night will just absolutely blow my mind, and you walk out going, "Wow, that's it."
Stay.
song Radio Free Europe, and REM's first full album, Murmur, is indelibly stamped in my memory, and even though they would never again use that four-on-the-floor rhythm again, the song received a respectable amount of airplay in spite of being a totally unknown band. REM lead singer Michael Stipe knew even then that the band couldn't rely on commercial radio in the long run.
Yeah, pop culture, particularly in the U.S., comes and goes, and everything moves in cycles, as things do, which we all realize as we grow older and wiser, whether it's politics or pop culture or music or what have you, people's taste, radio. Where we never made giant steps to make ourselves a viable, hit-making American band for American radio. Radio came to us, and to my count, probably three times in 23 years. Pop culture just swung into our little stubborn trajectory, and we were in the same orbit a couple times. And so we kind of merrily went along our stubborn little route. And in doing so, American pop culture moved in a very different direction. And I think the ways, and again, we're back to distribution, the ways that the people who are not music fans and go out and seek music, the way that they hear it or become aware of it is mostly through radio and television. It went off on its little path, and we went off on our little path. Our little path happened to take in a big chunk of the world, and there's a lot of people out there for whom REM didn't mean a whole lot in the 1980s.
South Central Rain is just one of the many fine songs on Murmur's 1984 follow-up called Reckoning. The do-it-yourself philosophy that has become standard for bands in the internet age was totally revolutionary when REM and Peter Buck were recording the Chronic Town EP in Mitch Easter's garage in 1981.
we had a surprising amount of interest from major labels, but it all seemed like it took a really long time. We talked to a couple people, and it was, you know, basically it's like a year process of them meeting you, and then you play for people, and then you go to dinner with them, and then they talk to you, and they put you in the studio to do demos. And we got to work in the RCA studios where Elvis recorded stuff in New York, I believe, and Lou Reed had done records there. You know, it was a pretty great experience. But it just looked like, well, it's going to take 1 year to do this. And at the time, we had a record recorded. We had Chronic 10 recorded. And one of the things about IRS was that they were willing to put the record out immediately. You know, it's like, you sign the deal, we'll start pressing records. And as a matter of fact, they were pressing records before we had literally signed the document, which was kind of cool. Because we're always going, well, you know, we could just not sign it. They'll be really screwed. But I like the immediacy of it, that we had had this piece of work done. We did it, and it seemed like a pretty nice way to enter into the business. With a record that we'd already made, no one could say, well, gee, you know, you're selling out by signing to a label, because this record was done. It was going to be on probably Murmur Records, was my guess. We probably would have called it. And so they were willing to just take us as we were. And we had a record out within 2 months or 3 months of signing. It just... My friends that were on major labels at the time in the early 80s, the business was kind of at this weird cusp of time where no one that was doing A&R seemed to understand what they were signing, and they were trying to turn what they're signing into what they'd signed in 1974. So you got a lot of kind of like punk-ish rock bands that would get totally smoothed down. There's no reason to sign a punk band if you're going to smooth them down.
From R.E.M.'s third album, Fables of the Reconstruction in 1985, put the band back on the radio. But R.E.M. had subscribed years earlier to a retail politics approach, says Peter Buck.
At the time, we were friends with Ian Copeland, who booked the police. And I like the whole Ian and Miles Copeland theory of that, you know, you play anywhere for any amount of money. You don't go into debt to your record company, or you don't borrow money. You make the records you want to make, and you get in the van and you tour. And so that's just what we did. I mean, we played for $40 a night, you know, for years.
$40.
Yeah, well, or The Door, which, you know.
Could be less.
Yeah. There were many an $8 night. But, you know, we never lost money on a tour. I mean, we'd always start a tour. We'd play one date in Athens so we could make like $800. You go to North Carolina, and we're kind of big in North Carolina. We'd maybe make $300. And then, you know, once you get out of that area, then we'd open for somebody. Maybe they'd give us $50 or $100 to open for Bow Wow Wow in Detroit. Or, you know, we'd play on a night that the club is usually closed, and the guy would just say, well, you can have The Door. And we'd get six people at $4 a shot. You know, I meet some of those people sometimes. Some of them I still see. And, you know, we remember shows when there was nobody there. We always have the legendary shows where nobody shows up. But, you know, somebody always shows up, and they remember it. Generally, it's like, oh, yeah, I saw you. And they'll name, you know, the Clutch Cargos in Detroit was the famous one. That was the one where everyone who showed up was on mescaline because it was a birthday party and they're all tripping and they saw the lights and it looked like a good place to go. And we went, well, that's pretty cool. You know, we played a private birthday party for these people and then went out to dinner with them.
On the whimsical Can't Get There From Here off of 1985's Fables of the Reconstruction by R.E.M. Next, Michael Stipe and Peter Buck return with new big-time producer, a fourth and then fifth album, and a top 10 hit. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and check out live REM from a 1987 Holland concert at inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard with early best of REM. Document.
Hi, this is Peter Buck of REM in the studio.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe for the best of REM in the studio, part one.
With Redbeard.
Thank you both. Document, which is one of three REM albums on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 of all time. Even though REM switched producers four times with their first five albums, including John Mellencamp hit producer Don Gaiman, those first five REM albums are sonically very consistent. REM guitarist Peter Buck says that being stubborn does have its merits.
The people at the record company tended to, they'd listen to the records and go, oh, that's a little different, or, you know, why do you want to do this? But we were, you know, we just figured that we knew what we were doing, or pretended that we knew what we were doing. A producer's role with us is kind of like, he's an arbiter when we have discussions or fights or arguments or whatever. He's supposed to capture the sounds. He's a cheerleader. He's supposed to get us excited about things. And also someone who will give us an idea that might push one of our ideas into a different dimension. But, you know, we write our own songs, and we do pretty extensive, I guess what you call pre-production by ourselves. So the songs are totally written and arranged, and we know have a good idea what instruments we want on it. So it's not as if things are going to be changing. I mean, the producer's job is to get us in there, capture it, you know, help us with the ideas we want to get. We frustrated a couple people. And, you know, I'll say, this isn't a put down in any stretch of the imagination. Don Gaiman was a great producer to work with, but he was frustrated because he felt that he was within just an inch or two of having a 10 million selling record. And that he felt that if we would follow his advice, that we could do that. And I was happy with the way the record turned out. And, you know, but Don had these long discussions with us, and he was fine with it. But he had just said, well, you know, he goes, I work with other people. And, you know, if I say, gee, we should do this, they'll do that. They'll rewrite the words and, you know, and cut the solo out or whatever. And I just, we always just say, well, you know, we think that this is the way this should be.
There's a problem with feathers on bargain buildings, weights and pulleys. Feathers hit the ground before the weight can leave the air. Buy the sky and sell the sky and tell the sky and tell.
Fall on Me comes from the 1986 REM fourth album, Life's Rich Pageant. If you believe all of the fawning assertions by certain music writers, then R.E.M.'s ascent to ultimate indie cred, as well as the top of the charts, rose on a graph at a 45-degree angle like a bottle rocket. Peter Buck of R.E.M. knows better.
Our career, for lack of a better word, looks so good in retrospect that it seems like it's planned out, but it certainly wasn't. I think that if you'd asked any of us in 1981 what we kind of wanted to do, we would have said, well, you know, maybe get on some small local label and put out a record a year and go to New York once a year, because that's what our friends did. You know, all our local bands, you know, put out a record that sold 7,000 copies, and you played New York and Washington, D.C. and Atlanta. And, you know, that's not a bad way to go. And then your local hometown heroes, and you play twice a month to pay the rent. And then you have a lot of time to write songs. And we were kind of hoping that we could get it to that level.
And do you think that was just being realistic? Or was there some insidious fear of it getting any bigger?
Well, I think it was realism. I mean, the early 80s was a pretty dry time as far as what was on radio and who was getting signed. And, you know, my guess was that we would never be on a major label, and I thought that'd be okay. But if you weren't on a major label, then you're not going to sell a lot of records, just almost by definition. You know, we wanted to just quit our day jobs. I mean, that was the big goal, is if we could quit our day jobs, then we're fine. I could live at whatever level that was, which would be about like $8,000 a year.
The time to rise has been engaged. Your better best to rearrange. I'm talking here to me alone. I listen to the finest work song. Your finest hour. Your finest hour. We'll be right back.
Finest Work Song is the song that serves as the preamble to REM's Document album, Never Sounding Better Than Now, 2-disc deluxe edition. Next, Michael Stipe and Peter Buck return with a breakthrough top 10 hit from Document. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and check out live REM from a 1987 Holland concert at inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard with Michael Stipe and Peter Buck in the studio on the anniversary of Document.
Hi, this is Peter Buck of REM in the studio.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe for the best of REM in the studio, part one.
With Redbeard.
This little college quartet that had first recorded in Mitch Easter's garage made Document in the country music capital of the world. Again, here's Peter Buck with me in the studio.
We always try to try different studios, just because every studio is different. We want to go to a different city, and the less of a formula to follow, the more you're likely to come up with something different. We picked Nashville because we liked it. We'd never spent time there. And we worked in a studio that was owned by Cowboy Jack Clement. He engineered a lot of the Sun Session stuff with Jerry Lee Lewis. And, you know, he's a kind of maniac. I liked the studio because it was decorated with furniture and paintings from his favorite French bordello that had gone out of business. He bought all the velvet couches. So it was kind of rococo. But it was also kind of a family thing, too, it seemed like. So a family studio type situation. It wasn't like a big Hollywood type thing. So we went to Nashville for 6 weeks, whatever it was. There were several bands that never really made it, but there was a lot of good players. And it was before the country thing kind of really happened, coming back. So there was all this kind of stuff on the margins. And it's also, it's, you know, it's a southern city, so none of us felt like we're really, you know, a million miles away from home. We didn't know a huge amount of people. So we just kind of, we settled into a house that one of the Dukes of Hazzard had rented before us, John Schneider. So we'd get his mail. And we'd go in the studio every day and make this record in a old French bordello looking place.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up an ox, beat grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down high. Fire in a fire representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down. My team reporters baffle Trump, tethered crop. Look at that, no plane, fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow, population common food. But it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs, listen to your heartbeat. Dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right. Right, you patriotic, patriotic. Slam, fight, bright, light, feeling pretty sight. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. Cotton board tower, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive incinerate. Light a candle, light a motor, step down, watch your heel crush, crush. Uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. Drifted by mountains, sit in a line. Leonard Bernstein, Leonard Brezhnev, Lenny Bruce and Lester Banks. Birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom. You symbiotic, patriotic, slam, but next. Right,
right.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Fine tradition of Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues with its stream of consciousness free association, REM scored a hit with the quirky It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. But with this and subsequent pop radio crossovers like Stand, for instance, some early REM uber fans started to get uneasy about REM's mainstream popularity manifesting itself in a way which I discussed with lead singer Michael Stipe of REM.
I used to get a smattering of calls on the request line back in 88 from just a few listeners claiming to be REM fans, claiming to speak on your behalf. They would deride the song and urge me not to play it, and I would be very confused by that. Where were these so-called fans getting the notion that you wanted to disown your then-current song?
Well, from the same place that I, as an 18-year-old, thought that Blondie had, quote, sold out when they did Heart of Glass, and I dismissed them as a sellout band that I would have nothing to do with, and I wasn't interested in anything that they did from that moment forward. And, of course, I look back at that record and realize how very brilliant and how very ballsy it was for them to integrate disco into their music. That took balls like church bells, and they did it. And they did it very successfully. It's a great record. Did I recognize or realize that as an 18-year-old? No. I just saw my heroes doing something that I thought was stretching further beyond. You know, people get very territorial about the things that inspire them and the things that they enjoy, whether it's music or other mediums and the people that create those mediums. And so I'm not surprised that you got a lot of calls from people saying, don't play this, it's crap. And
actually, it wasn't a lot of calls.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not surprised that you got some calls.
Hang your collar up inside. Hang your dollar on me. Listen to the water still. Listen to the causeway. You are mad and educated, primitive and wild. Welcome to the occupation. Here we stand and here we fight. All your fallen heroes held and died and skinned alive. Listen to the Congress fire, offering the educated, primitive and loyal. Welcome to the occupation. Hang your collar up inside. Hang your freedom higher. Listen to the buyer still. Listen to the Congress where propagate confusion, primitive and wild. Fire on the hemisphere below. Listen to
It's important to remember that this album was conceived in the Reagan era, amidst the Iran-Contra congressional hearings and the massive welfare cutbacks in the U.S. then. The original punk rock movement of the Ramones, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, it was meant much more to be an ending rather than a beginning, a binge and purge high colonic of rock and roll. Something had to come next, and it was U2 and REM. However, there was still some post-punk hangover, as I discussed with REM lead guitarist Peter Buck in the studio.
Document particularly was kind of a chaotic look at all that. I still feel the same way, that whatever use we get out of the government is being cut back drastically so that rich people can get tax breaks and so that we can build weapons that we don't need. Look at the way they're cutting the budget now. I mean, no one has suggested that rich people should pay more taxes. I'm one of them, and I think we should. I mean, I think it's really weird. And so what they're doing is cutting, you know, the aids to dependent children funds, you know? I mean, yeah, let's have a couple kids go hungry so we can continue to manufacture bombs and planes that when we have to use them in the war don't really work. It's really weird. I just can't understand what's going on. So, you know, we do our political stuff on the side. I mean, we'd fund things because the government isn't going to do it. Well, I think it's kind of a great thing. I mean, in a way, you know, discussed with your government can turn out to be a very positive thing. You know, I mean, I think we've got a great constitution in this country. You know, no other country has what we have. I think that they're running it the wrong way. And until they see fit to take care of their citizens, then I guess a lot of us are going to have to do it. Not that I do that much. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm really a saint or anything. But lots of people who have regular jobs and don't have a lot of money, volunteer time, cash when it's possible. I think that's a very positive thing. I think you can look at the government or the way it's kind of screwing things up. And maybe if it makes people like us get a little bit more involved in the real world aspect of, you know, hunger and homelessness, then it's a good thing.
Yeah.
REM's breakout hit from Document, The One I Love, was deceptively simple. Take away the electric guitar cabs and Bill Berry's fat drum sound, slow it down by half, and play it only on an acoustic guitar, and suddenly you can imagine The One I Love as ancient as Traffic's John Barleycorn Must Die. Here's Peter Buck.
It's a folk song. It's that kind of folk song structure. But if you grew up with folk music, it's fun to kind of adapt those kind of songs and those ideas. I mean, it's not a particular song, but it's just a... Funnily enough, we wrote it the week after we finished recording Lycerge Pageant. We always try to write new songs to go on the road with. So we did it all the tour for Lycerge Pageant. We did that song. And it was funny because that year, you know, no one really noticed it. It was in the set, and I was like, oh, that's a pretty good song. And then the next year, you know, we recorded it, and it was a top 10 single. The next year, it was the one song everyone wanted to hear.
But closer inspection of Michael Stipe's seemingly innocent love song lyrics on The One I Love reveal an uneasy contradiction.
There's a couple lines, yeah. Well, it's funny because I was going, gee, Michael, don't you think you want to change the second verse? And he goes, well, I said exactly what I wanted to say. You know, the point being that, you know, it's like the first verse is the love song, so it's the exact same words. And then the second verse, the third song, when you realize that he's changed it to say that the person is a prop to occupy his time.
Changed one line.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it's like, gee, that's kind of callous and cold-hearted. And I see people when, you know, the times we play it holding hands and like sing it to each other. And it's like, well, the last verse maybe undercuts that a little bit. It's like that police song, Every Breath You Take. I mean, the guy I think is going to kill her, you know, maybe in the fourth verse.
It's almost like a stalker.
Well, he is a stalker, and it's really creepy. And if someone said that to me, I'd, you know, hire a detective to watch me. But and that's good. It's sometimes nice to play with those expectations. You have a love song that isn't really a love song, you know, or is maybe a love song that's more callous than people think it is.
I will rearrange your scales if I can, and I can. I'm to eat each one of you, and you, me, you. I had a hat and a sun reached down, picked it up, slapped it on my head. All the people gathered, collided, to carry each his burden. We are young despite the years, we are concerned. We are hurt despite the times. Oh, sudden out these days, happy throngs take this joy. Wherever, wherever, I wish to meet each one of you. And you, me, you, if I can, and I can. We have many things in common, man. Like the years, we are concerned, we are hurt despite the times. Oh, sudden out these days, happy throngs take this joy, wherever, wherever you go. Wherever you go.
I'm Red Beard, back in the studio after this. This is Red Beard in the studio, thanking my guests, Michael Stipe and Peter Buck. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Red Beard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Red Beard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net.